Welcome to the New Species Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Albion. On this podcast, we learn about recent discoveries of species that are new to science, but not necessarily new to nature. We ask scientists how they found these new species and why they matter. We learn about what makes a new species and hear some behind-the-scenes stories along the way. So join us as we explore the biodiversity of our planet and the scientists who help us better understand it. Welcome to the New Species Podcast. I'm your host, Zoe Albion, and I'm here with Mike Steffen, creator of the Tautonyms Instagram account and author of Tautonyms, the book published last year. He's here today to talk to us about etymologies of all shapes and sizes across taxonomy. Welcome, Mike. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Hey, Zoe. Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here. I'm a big fan of the New Species Podcast, and I'm happy to help answer any questions about zoological or botanical or other taxonomical etymology as best I can.
Yeah, this was a topic that was requested by several people and is also just like a personal interest of mine. Can you start off by sort of introducing yourself and sharing a little bit about how you became interested in etymology?
Sure. So I should start with a disclaimer that I am not a professional zoologist or a professional taxonomist or a professional ist of any relevant kind. I am merely a guy, a lawyer by trade, who enjoys history, etymology, language, wildlife, and where all of those things intersect seems to be in the etymology of animal names and in scientific names in particular. I started looking at animal etymologies really maybe 3.5 years ago during the pandemic. I was writing a letter to someone and made a joke about lawyers. I said that, you know, what's the difference between a dead lawyer in the middle of the road and a dead skunk in the middle of the road? And the answer is there are skid marks in front of the skunk. And that got me thinking that, you know, maybe I would be more happy in my life, not as a lawyer, but in studying skunks. And what would you call a person who studies skunks? And that led me down the Wikipedia rabbit hole of learning what a mephitologist is. That's a person who studies skunks. And well, where does the word mephitologist come from? That comes from the scientific name of the striped skunk, which is Mephitis mephitis, named after the Samnite goddess of foul-smelling gases. So I found that very interesting. I like mythology and history and learning where words come from. But that also taught me about the concept of tautonyms, a scientific name of an animal that is a single word repeated, Mephitis mephitis. How many more names like this exist? Why are they formed in this way? Is it historical accident or is there some pattern or purpose to it? I started looking into it, and over the course of a few months, I had collected quite a few tautonyms and researched their etymologies. And this project continued for quite some time to the point now, 3.5 years later, where I have now a small publication on the issue and an Instagram account dedicated to it.
And I certainly enjoy your Instagram account. Such a treat to scroll through and see all of these really interesting tautonyms. Briefly, you've defined a tautonym. Can you tell us what a tautonym is not?
Sure. So a tautonym, as I said, is a scientific name of an animal, or for that matter, a bacteria or a plant or a prokaryote or some other organism, in which both parts of the binomial name are identical words. So a binomial name or a binomen, as you know, is really a generic name and a specific name, or if you're in botany, a specific epithet. Where those two words are identical, you have a tautonym. Vulpes vulpes, the red fox is an example. Bison bison, gorilla gorilla, there are many. There are around 700 by my count of the 1.2 million species that we think have been described. So it's got to be identical spelling in both. You will have words that sometimes have similar spelling, such as the meerkat scientific name is Suricata suricata. Now, you wouldn't know from me saying it, but the two suricatas are not spelled the same. One of them has two T's and one of them has one T. So the meerkat is a near tautonym, not an actual tautonym. You also have names in which each word means the same thing, but the words are different. Ursos arctos, a species of bear, literally means bear in Latin and in Greek. But because those two parts of the binomial are different, that's not a tautonym. Similar names are Felis catus and Ovis aries. So there are quite a few near tautonyms out there. Those that I just described would be called pleonasms. But my focus really, at least for the purposes of my book and my Instagram account at present, is just on the true tautonyms, which there really aren't that many of them, but they're fun when you find them.
And I know they're allowed in zoology, but they're actually prohibited in botany. Can you explain why?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. This was something that I have always been wondering since I started this project 3.5 years ago. The botanical nomenclatural rules, or their code, serves a similar, if not identical, purpose to the zoological nomenclatural code. These codes are designed to create rules by which we name animals and plants so that they have unique identifiers, so that scientists and other people communicating about them can do so consistently and without vagueness or ambiguity. Why would it be that tautonyms would be allowed in one code but not in another? That seemed bizarre to me. I searched for the answer high and low for years. I read many, if not every version of the botanical nomenclatural code that ever existed going back to the mid-1800s. Some of those are in French and had to have many sections translated. And the answer just isn't explicit. It's not there. However, having read all of those codes, all of the zoological codes, the codes for prokaryotes, which is bacteria, the codes for cultivated plants, the codes for viruses, I've come up with, I think, a reasonably strong hypothesis as to how this occurred in botany. And the answer is simply historical accident and institutional momentum. Back in, you know, the early days of formalized botanical nomenclature, a specific epithet could be capitalized when the epithet is referring to a person's name. Now, you know, you and I and many of the listeners to this podcast will know that in zoological nomenclature, the way you write an animal's name is by capitalizing the generic name, like Homo, and putting in lowercase the specific name, Sapiens. But going back 150 years, that wasn't always the case in botany. You could capitalize both words if the species name or the specific epithet was named after an individual person. So if we were to name, you know, a plant the Zoe plant, and you named it Zoe Zoe, you could capitalize both Z's. Now, that doesn't seem like it would be all that confusing or concerning, but it does become confusing to the extent that a person refers only to one of those two taxa when speaking. So if I were to say, this Zoe plant I found is really beautiful, you might not know in the letter that I hand wrote you whether the Zoe plant is a plant within the genus Zoe or the specific Zoe species. So for that reason, botanists said, look, we don't want the names to be the same for the generic name or the specific name. It could be too confusing when you refer to just one of the taxa and not the other. The same problem was considered by zoologists who around that same time came up with their own rule, which was just make the second one lowercase. Make the second name lowercase, and the eye will immediately be able to distinguish the rank of that taxon. So that's sort of the history of the rule. Now, it's the case, you know, as a matter of both recommendation and practice in botany, that all specific epithets are written with lowercase letters. So my view is that there really isn't a reason any longer to prohibit tautonyms in botany. But, you know, there's a lot of institutional momentum against tautonyms in botany. And I think it's unlikely they'll change the rule anytime soon. But I have proposed in the journal Taxon that botanists reconsider this rule in light of the history that I just explained, and in light of the fact that bacteriologists and zoologists have been able to live with tautonyms for many decades without throwing the science into confusion or contempt.
I will definitely link that paper in the description. In addition to having these awesome Instagram posts to scroll through, you also have a contest regarding tautonyms.
Yeah, it's less of a contest and more of just a fun thing I do with the community of followers that we have. It's called Drawtonyms, and this is the fourth year I've done it. I'm inviting any of my followers, or really anyone at all, to draw any tautonym of their choosing, send it to me over Instagram and I'll post it to the account. It's just a fun thing that we do. Occasionally, we will make a fundraiser out of it, or I will, you know, donate to the World Wildlife Fund for everybody who participates. And I'd be happy to do that again this year. So if anyone on the New Species podcast wants to draw a totonym, you can just pick out whichever one you want. It can be a former totonym. It can even be a pleonasm if you want, or a near totonym. Draw it, send it to me, and I'll post it to the account, and I'll maybe donate to everybody who does one of those. I think you should have more contests among your listeners. Maybe people can draw a new species and send it into you, and you can you know, post it to your account.
I would be extremely excited about that. Let's do it.
Hi, post-recording Zoe here. I think this is a great idea. If you want to draw a new species, say, from the last 5 years, please go right ahead and email the picture and your name and or your Instagram handle to me at newspeciespodcast@gmail.com. At the end of April, I'll share them all in an Instagram post. I can't wait to see them. And let's get back to the show.
I'll tell you this. There have been times when I have been unable to find a usable photo of an animal that I'd like to post on my totonyms page. And so I'll ask someone to draw it for me based on the description. And the person who does this for me most of the time is also the person who provided the illustrations for my book. And he does a pretty good job. But if I see any drawings of hard to find totonyms through the Drawtonyms contest, I'll have to post those as well.
It's a great intersection of science and art. I'm a big fan. So you wrote an entire book about totonyms, which means you did a tremendous amount of research. What does that sort of involve?
Yeah, there's, you know, a lot to that goes into this. And I would say that there are basically two major areas of research. The first is finding the totonyms, and the second is determining their etymologies. Finding totonyms is not as easy as one might think. As I'm sure you know, there is no single definitive list of all animals that have ever been described. There's not even a single definitive list of all reptiles, or even within that, lizards that have ever been described. To find out the species that exists on planet Earth is to look at a variety of usually public sources, whether it's books that you can get from the library or Wikipedia or iNaturalist or, you know, thousands of websites dedicated to specific animals. So the first step is just finding the totonyms. I've been very lucky in that there have been a small handful of people over the last 50 to 100 years who have put together lists of totonyms. The totonyms Wikipedia page is one of those lists that I have contributed to heavily. So I've aggregated a lot, lots of those lists. I've been lucky to have a number of my followers are zoologists in different fields, and they will send me totonyms that they find or that get named in their research. That's a very helpful resource as well. And some of it is just brute force, if you will. I've noticed patterns in where totonyms tend to occur, and sometimes I will just manually review thousands of scientific names within a given family or order in the hopes that I can find some. And I often do. So finding the totonyms is one massive task. And I have no doubt that my book is incomplete in that there's probably some obscure totonym that I haven't found, or maybe that was named or reclassified since my book came out. And that's what makes totonyms really a lifelong thing for me, potentially, is updating this list as things change. The other research is determining etymologies, and this is where some art and creativity comes into play. As you may know, more modern descriptions of animals tend to include a section, a sentence or two, on the etymology of the name that's assigned. I've noticed that that's been the case usually within the last 50 years or so. However, if you look at animal names that were created 100 years ago or 200 years ago or longer, they almost never contain any sort of clue as to the etymological origin of the name. So what you do in that instance, what I would do is I would read the original description of the animal and perhaps any reclassification descriptions of the animal and look for clues that might connect its scientific name to its habitat or its distribution or its morphology or its behavior. An example is the European greenfinch. The name of this animal is Chloris chloris. It's a small green bird. Its name appears to come from the Greek word chloros, meaning green. It's not, you know, an inferential leap to make that connection. The same can be said of Pyropi pyropi. the fire-eyed diucon, a small passerine bird, I think, in South America. It's mostly gray in color and has two bright, vivid, coral red eyes. There's no doubt that the name Pyropi Pyropi comes from the Greek per for fire and opsis meaning eye. So in most instances, it's reasonably clear what the animal was named after. But there are quite a few examples where, you know, either because of the name itself being unclear from what language it comes, or because of the sort of generic characteristics of the animal, it's really hard to tell. This was a major impediment for me with New World skippers. These are lepidopterans similar to butterflies and moths. I think I have something like 45 of them that are totonyms or former totonyms. Almost every single one of them is brown, the same size, basically nondescript, from South America, and they live in virtually identical habitats. So figuring out why one brown skipper is named Joanna Joanna or Tosta Tosta, and another one is named Pomba Pomba, is quite difficult. And most of these animals, by the way, of those skippers are distinguished on the basis of their reproductive organs. And I, you know, have no ability to examine the reproductive organs of a Tosta Tosta, much as I might like to, you know, really get in there. I can't do it. So, you know, more research is required. You know, I may have to like look into the naming conventions or the naming practices of a particular entomologist, as I did in that case, to put together a theory that would help explain it. You know, maybe the person had a nephew named Tosta or, you know, a cousin named Joanna. So there is some level of speculation that comes into learning names or the history of animal names. There's a quote from, I think, a naturalist named Gill. I've got it in the book somewhere. It's something along the lines of, you know, much as we might like to know the origin of all the animal names that exist, some of them are just lost to history, and you may have to accept that they're not available to you. But I've done my best to make, you know, reasonably competent explanations of each of the animals that I've come across. And it's fun to learn new languages, learn about new languages, and learn about the different influences that can shape our zoological etymology.
What was the solution that you found to that sort of skipper problem?
Yeah, so great question. So there's an entomologist named W.H. Evans who was responsible for either classifying or reclassifying something like 50 different skippers that became to have tautonomous names. And in that particular example, what I did was I pulled a 4-volume treatise that he wrote about New World skippers in the early 1950s. I actually had to have a library rent these from a British library because the 4-volume treatise is just not, you know, at every library in Los Angeles, as you can imagine. And I looked at all of the different animals or many of the different lepidopterans that he named through the course of this 4-volume treatise. And I mean, looking at names, not just tautonomous names, but all names, to look for patterns and try to get a sense for what this guy may have been going for. And in the course of doing that, I actually realized that for many of these names, what he would do is make up a name more or less arbitrarily from a fragment of the name of the locality where the type specimen was found. And so, for example, Tosta Tosta was named because the type specimen was found in Iquitos. And so he took the T-O-S from Iquitos and turned that into Tosta Tosta. Now that might seem pretty far-fetched, but he did this across several different names. You have a Tosta Tosta from Iquitos, a Pomba Pomba from Balsapomba, Ecuador. So I sort of saw that pattern, and then I went back through the totonyms I had to solve and put that out there as a potential explanation for how those names came into be. There are other examples which are similarly vexing where the name itself might be pretty clear. I think there's a saucer-eyed porgy whose name comes from a Greek word meaning reed, R-E-E-D, but it's unclear whether the reference to a reed is because the spine on their anal fin is hollow and reed-like, or if it's because they like to live in areas where there are many different reeds within a lake or an ocean or something like that. So, you know, I try to explain, you know, where names are unclear or ambiguous or speculative But that's really a lot of the fun is trying to learn where these names came from in the first instance.
You have to be like a historian and a linguist and a geographer wearing all these hats to kind of solve the mystery.
Yeah, and I'm really none of those things. Not specifically, but I do enjoy it, and I enjoy language, and a lot of being a lawyer is analyzing language, analyzing rules, and trying to understand, what things mean. So maybe that's a skill set that is useful here.
Absolutely. So as we kind of get more and more into this conversation, I am really curious about the sort of history of this type of taxon-related etymology. Can you give us a crash course?
Sure, I'll do my best. So the history of scientific names, I'm sure you and your followers are somewhat familiar with. You had polynomial descriptions of animal names basically before 1758. These would be short descriptions in Latin about an animal. This is a red bird found in South America, something along those lines. In 1758, Carl Linnaeus comes along and formalizes binomial nomenclature, or nomenclature for zoology, with binomial nomenclature. So from 1758 onward, we're all using two word names. That's what binomial nomenclature means. And the idea was still that you would be able to describe what the animal is through the two words, and it would be a unique combination of words, basically acting like an SKU or a unique identifying number for the animal, so that anybody who's looking at this animal or reading about it, knows exactly what it is. We're all talking about the same thing. Well, as popular as binomial nomenclature was in 1758 and the years that followed, it wasn't, there were still some rules to fill in, some requirements that we needed to figure out. And the key date here, the key time, is 1841. In 1841, an English ornithologist and geologist named Hugh Edwin Strickland decided to try to streamline and improve the way that zoologists refer to scientific names of animals. He thought that there was a problem in that there wasn't necessarily agreement among the different zoologists of what to call each animal. We're not talking about disagreements in classification. We're talking about where they agree as to the classification, but a disagreement into what name should be assigned to that animal. He had this hypothetical problem, or maybe it was a real problem, of an English naturalist going to a museum in France and finding that the scientific language was just as foreign and confusing as the local vernacular language. And he felt that this was a real impediment to scientific discussion across countries and cultures. So Hugh Strickland decides to put together what would become the first set of nomenclatural rules that really ever existed. And in 1841, he circulated these rules to 213 naturalists within England and abroad. And he received feedback from them, consolidated it, made edits, and then he went to one of the leading and most well-known scientific institutions of the time, which was the British Association for the Advancement of Science. And he said, "This is an important thing we need to get right. Will you please support this new set of zoological nomenclatural rules and try to get your scientists to start using it?" And the association said, "Look, this seems, kind of interesting. We have a lot of interesting things going on. Why don't you see if people within our ranks will be on a committee with you and, get opinions from others and, take this as far as you want." So Strickland forms a committee of something like 15 or 16 other English naturalists and scientists. They were, I think, all men. Many of them were tied to the church in some way, shape, or form. But they come from a variety of different disciplines, including entomology, geology, botany, zoology, and all kinds. I should add, there was even one person who was a lawyer and a malacologist. So lawyers like me have had influence since the early days. And one of the members of the committee was Charles Darwin. This was after he had published his Voyage of the Beagle, but before he had published On the Origin of Species. This committee met, they went through some drafts, they sent out their drafts to a survey of 32 naturalists, and they came up with basically a final set of zoological nomenclatural rules, which they presented to the 1842 meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. And that was published in the records of that association and became really the first ever nomenclatural rule set for zoology, and it would pave the way for and ultimately become the International Commission and International Code on Zoological Nomenclature.
And that's kind of what we have today.
That's exactly what we have today. Now, a lot of the rules have changed quite a bit. You know, back then there was a goal, as the code itself explains, of providing not only terms that will lend themselves to scientific accuracy, but they also wanted names that would exhibit, in their words, literary elegance. And so they came up with many different rules on how you can name things, what types of words you can use. It was really very restrictive. It's not as nearly restrictive today. In fact, it's very unrestricted today, and people have a lot of latitude into what they name things, as I'm sure you know. But, you know, some of the restrictions that no longer exist today include things like names based on geographies. These zoologists didn't want animal scientific names to include geographies, because their concern was that if the animal is ever found outside of that geography, then the name would no longer be accurate. The example they give is the Javanese bird Hirundo javanica. They thought if this bird ever leaves Java, then it would, in their words, not tell the whole truth about the animal. Another good example is mythological names. In their words, mythological names would be in bad taste, but only if the myth in question has no perceptible reference to the characteristics of the animal being named. So you could name an owl in the genus Athena because of the mythological representation of the goddess Athena as an owl, but you could not name a land animal Poseidon or some derivation of Poseidon because he's the god of the sea. Of course, you could name a horse after Poseidon because he was also the god of horses, having turned himself into a horse, but that is a complete digression. And the idea was that, you know, you can name things after myths, but only if there's some connection between the myth and the animal itself, which, as we know, is already a fairly, you know, arbitrary thing to begin with.
I definitely see the place for lawyers in these conversations. The potential for loopholes is immense.
Yeah, no, I like looking at this and thinking about some of those loopholes. And, you know, the whole thing is just an exercise in poor lawmaking, if you ask me. But it's amusing to look at it in retrospect. Another example is words that sound, in their words, harsh or inelegant, or words more than five syllables in length. What is a harsh word? What's an inelegant word? They gave examples, but there seem no more harsh than many of the other words that we come across. But I suppose those examples will show, you know, maybe a European bias or an English or French bias towards, you know, the words that were used. They also wrote that they discouraged words that combine two or more parts of different words. So if you were to name an animal Zolbion, combining Zoe and Albion, they would find this to be, and I quote, as deformed a monster in nomenclature as a mermaid or a centaur would be in zoology. So they had some very strong opinions. Now, as we know, anything goes. Names can be arbitrary. They can be based on anagrams. They can be really based on anything at all. And my sense is that the reason for that change is because just the sheer number of animals that need to be named is so great, and likely so much greater than zoologists believed it would be in 1842, that now the doors are wide open and you can name an animal pretty much anything. Although, having said all that, I will say that these folks in 1842, Charles Darwin among them, seemed to be concerned for me personally, because one of the rules that they wrote was to discourage what they call nonsense names. These are names that are coined at random without any meaning whatsoever, like an anagram or like a random organizing of letters to an animal name. And the reason they discourage this as being in bad taste is because they were worried that etymologists in the future, perhaps people like me, would be unable to understand why an animal received the name that it did. So I do appreciate their concern for the work of etymologists. And I included that quotation, I think, at the start of the Todonyms book.
It sounds like if you're going to go off the rails, just document it well.
Yeah, absolutely. And people will do that. There is, I think there's at least one toponym in the book that was created within the last 30 or 40 years. And it's explicitly an anagram of, you know, the name of an animal in a similar genus or something along those lines.
There's so much creativity in the way that we name species and genera and other taxa. I really enjoyed an episode, I believe last year, with Stefano Mamola, who discussed his paper on tracking trends in spider names across the community. And he found some really interesting things. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of evolutions you've seen in naming trends throughout your research?
Yeah, that's a great, it's a great topic and it's a great question. And Stefano's episode was wonderful. If he's listening, I really enjoyed it. If you'd ever like to talk about spider names, you know, drop me a line. Something that I will probably be doing now that the book is done and before, you know, I put together another publication will be looking at the trends within totonyms. If there's trends in terms of time, trends in terms of how things are named. I've always been interested in knowing whether there's more names that derive from an animal's morphology versus its behavior versus where it's found. You're not going to be able to tell that across the animal kingdom just from the small sample size of totonyms. But, you know, from my somewhat anecdotal experience, I think that I think the one major trend that has occurred within the last maybe 30 to 50 years, again, somewhat anecdotally, is a reversion toward more local vernacular names being the basis for scientific names than had been the case in the past. Back in the times of Linnaeus and the 100 years or so that followed, you see a lot of names based on morphology. You see a lot of names based on mythology. You know, eventually you sort of run out of names. You know, there's a lot of white small mollusks out there, and they can't all be named the white small mollusk. And so, you know, people sort of run out of options. And something that you see a lot, at least within the totonyms world, within South Indian catfish, is names based on local vernacular Bengali words. And this is something that the zoologist who studied all of those fish sort of decided he would do. And I think now, as zoologists and people in general are becoming more perhaps culturally aware, culturally sensitive, and appreciative of local practices, local language, local vernacular, local custom, you're seeing more of a reversion toward those types of names as being the basis of names. And there's no reason that those names can't be fun and interesting and tell their own story. The example I like to give is that of a small fish in a lake in Western Cameroon. The local vernacular name in Burumbi for this fish is Miaka Miaka. And in 1972, when zoologists discovered this fish and decided to describe it for the first time, rather than giving it a name based on some myth or naming it the small Cameroon fish, they named it Miaka Miaka as a way of honoring and recognizing the local people of Western Cameroon. And in doing so, they created a totonym, which is something I'm personally very appreciative of.
That's such a gem. I think that is one of my favorite toponyms so far. So there are a lot of conventions that encourage things like incorporating language and culture. There are also some sort of taboos. And one of them specifically that I didn't think about until I started talking to people not involved in taxonomy about taxonomy is the way that it's discouraged to name a species after yourself. This is something that I think a lot of people assume is just really normal to find a species and describe it and name it after yourself. But in the scientific community, it's highly, highly discouraged. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I'd love to. And, you know, again, I will remind the audience that I do not identify myself as a scientist. I will beg for anyone's forgiveness if I get some of these things wrong. But in my experience, and I speak in generalities, scientists tend to be fairly humble people. Real scientists tend to be terrified of being wrong, and they try to be very measured in the work that they do. They try to be very specific, and they try to get answers right in good faith. And I think this sense of humility is one that permeates both botanical sciences and zoological sciences and others. And I think that this is the sort of groundwork for the rule that you just described, or the custom you just described, of not naming an animal after yourself. The idea being that to name an animal or a plant or a bacteria after yourself would be a very vain thing to do. And in fact, this is on the ICZN website FAQ page. They ask, can you name an animal after yourself? And the answer is you can, but would you really want to? It would be quite a self-centered, narcissistic thing to do. The better practice, and the practice that's been basically in place for 200 or 300 years, is to name an animal after someone who has contributed to the science, someone else who has really done something good for maybe conservation or taxonomy or another science, geology perhaps. Name an animal that honors someone else. And if you're really so interested in having an animal named after you, then maybe someone else in another field of taxonomy will name an animal after you, you know, if your contributions are significant and sincere. So that's where the taboo comes from. And the same taboo exists in botany. But that's what goes into it. It's the idea that you want to be humble. And I should add as well, as you know, that anyone who describes an animal for the first time will already have their name sort of enshrined in history through that description. If you're worried about your legacy and you're naming an animal, you've already got that covered just from the fact that you got to describe an animal for the first time.
Absolutely. I love looking through a collection or key and seeing specific epithets where scientists are referencing each other.
Yeah, and there's no, you know, one of the things that I like about this field is that there's no really wrong way to name an animal. And there are so many animals that have yet to be discovered that, you know, we can name them after, you know, basically anything we want these days. There are very amusing names. There are some that are, you know, very heartfelt, as you said, others that help refer to important stories or myths or belief systems. And so all of these names in some perhaps unintended way tell the greater story of human anthropology and history.
That's beautiful. I feel like I was just listening to like a David Attenborough documentary.
Well, there are quite a few animals named after David Attenborough. I think it's something in like the 40s or 50s. So maybe someday, you know, in the future, some follower of yours will be listening to this podcast and just decide to name, you know, an animal after me because of how sort of poetic I'm feeling at this moment.
I could believe it. There actually is a species named after this podcast. Alireza Zamani, who was interviewed on the podcast the first year it was in production, actually named a new species after the creator of the podcast because of his work in science communication.
That's amazing.
It was so cool. It was a really big deal for Brian.
That's amazing. Wow. That's very cool. So taboo replacement is another thing that happens with animal names. It happens less probably with scientific names and more with common names. And the idea of taboo replacement is this. Taboo replacement occurs when an animal is not called by its so-called true name because of a superstitious belief that saying the name out loud will cause something bad to happen. So for example, bears were once feared as very dangerous beasts by ancient inhabitants of Eurasia. So instead of calling them by whatever their true name was, they were called something that sounds like bear or like medved, which is, I think, of Russian origin, meaning something like brown one or honey eater. Similar things happen to the wolf and fox species. The fear was that by saying the so-called true name of these animals, you would call it forth when you were not prepared for it. The same thing happens, I think, probably today when people go fishing, right? If they say, we're going to catch a lot of fish today on their drive to the lake, the buddy might say, no, don't say that. You're going to jinx us. And that's a taboo replacement where you don't say something because you're afraid that by saying it, something bad will happen. And that occurred long ago with deer and with fish and animals that were being hunted. If you somehow said its name, you would somehow let them know that they were being hunted. So taboo replacement has occurred across many different animals in the animal kingdom. And as a result, very early animal names like that of the bear and the deer and the fox, have really been lost to us probably forever. And as I said, this taboo still exists today in the feeling of feeling jinxed or saying things like, God forbid, or knocking on wood, speak of the devil. All of this is still continuing to go on. So that's how taboo replacement can impact animal names.
The history of etymology is such a rich text.
Yeah, well, you know, I guess what I'll say is sometimes the absence of a name, like with taboo replacement, you know, tells the story of what early people thought about specific animals. We can trace the names of many animals, but not of the bear and the fox and the wolf, because those were scary. So that tells us something about what early human beings thought about some of these animals. And that's really what I think is the most interesting aspect of zoological etymology, is that these names tell us something about humans' relationship with each other, humans' relationships with wildlife, with nature in general. And they're, in a sense, a link to the past, in that they can, you know, remind us of ancient myths and beliefs and things of that nature. So you have, you know, my example of the skunk, who's named after the goddess of foul-smelling gases. But there are many, there are quite a few, and, you know, I'll give you a couple of my favorites. One is Remora remora. This is the remora fish. It's a small ocean fish with a modified dorsal fin, where that fin acts as a suction cup. And it uses that suction cup to attach itself to animals larger than itself, like sharks, where it can feed on the debris that sharks leave behind. The name remora comes from the Latin word meaning hindrance or delay, and it reflects the ancient belief that this very small fish could attach itself to the hulls of ships and stop them from sailing. And this was first described by Pliny the Elder, a first century Roman philosopher, naturalist, and lawyer, who wrote that Mark Antony lost the pivotal Battle of Actium against Octavian because one of these tiny remora fish attached itself to the bottom of Antony's warship at the exact right moment when Antony was mounting his attack, causing some very brief delay in the battle. Antony ended up losing the battle. He ended up committing suicide with Cleopatra and lost the entire Roman Empire, and human history was never the same. So this fish named Remora might mean nothing to a person on the street, but when you understand that the name refers to this delay and its connection to ancient history and Cleopatra and Octavian Caesar, it, you know, it's interesting, and it helps sort of bridge the gap of mythology and history to modern day zoology.
There should be so much more coverage of fish in history, is what I'm hearing.
I mean, fish are major players. Fish are major players in history. They really are. There are some very odd connections between animals and history. Another is the salamander, the fire salamander. This is a name from ancient Persian that means lives in fire. And this comes from an ancient belief that salamanders would either be born in or live in actual fire. This is not a true myth. If you were to throw a salamander on a fire, it would die immediately. I believe Pliny the Elder actually did that, and nevertheless said that he must have gotten a bad one or something, and they live in fire. But the origin of this myth is a little unclear. It's likely that what happened was, you know, humans would be warming themselves by a fire. They would go outside, they would grab a damp log, and they would throw this damp log on the fire to keep the fire going. Little did they know that there was a little salamander sleeping in the log. And so when it gets a little hot, the salamander wakes up and crawls out of it. And people interpreted that as salamanders being born from fire. So here you don't have so much of an emphasis on, you know, ancient wars, but you have an interesting, you know, story that paints a picture for you and tells you a bit about how early people lived and just how susceptible they were to myth like this.
And I'm sure that our more recent species say a lot about us too.
Oh, no doubt. I mean, the Miaka Miaka name that we mentioned is a good one because it tells me about maybe the people of Western Cameroon. And if I were to dive into the origin of that name and the etymology of that in the Burundi language, I would learn more about them. And that's why I think naming animals can be important. It is an opportunity to preserve an idea or a person's name or a myth or a custom or a people forever or as long as taxonomic science exists. And so those who get to name animals are very fortunate in that they get to sort of, you know, preserve these ideas, perhaps indirectly, forever.
What do you think your role as an etymologist is sort of in that legacy?
Well, candidly, I don't know that my role is terribly important. Taxonomic science is important. It's important to conservation and it's important to our overall understanding of the animal kingdom and the world in which we live. So I have a great deal of respect for taxonomic science. Etymology, you know, it's fun. And this is, you know, a hobby of mine. It's something that I pursue passionately, but I realize that, you know, if I don't do the work that I'm doing, humans are going to be all right. Having said that, I do think that animal name etymology and taxonyms in particular might be something of a gateway for people who are otherwise not interested in taxonomy to learn about this science. Children seem to love taxonyms. They're easy to remember. Adults seem to like taxonyms as well. You will see occasionally pop science articles and websites dedicated to this topic or dedicated to unusual animal names. And these are all ways in which I think that we in the scientific community can engage with non-scientists around this field that is otherwise, you know, feeling very foreign and perhaps dry to them. So my hope is that with my research and the etymological discoveries I've made, I can encourage more people to pay attention to this important topic and maybe invest more resources, more energy into taxonomy, and maybe even inspire people who would otherwise not be interested in it to take it up and become taxonomists and specialize in something like that.
I mean, your story at the beginning, you were inspired by a taxonym and look where you are now.
Here I am on the New Species Podcast.
Well, it's been so great to have you. Thank you so much. And keep us updated with all the new taxonyms. And if people have described a new taxonym, they should get in touch with you.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to speak to anyone who either describes a new taxonym or who is naming animals, any taxonomist of any kind. I'm always interested in learning more about how you name animals. If you need help in crafting a word that's properly Latinized or, you know, coming up with any sort of names or etymological explanations for things, I can always be a resource, whether it's taxonyms or not. My book, Taxonyms, I should add 100% of what I receive as the author, I donate to the World Wildlife Fund. So if you're interested in learning more about how to contribute to that and receive a book, please, by all means, reach out. And thank you, Zoe, for what you're doing on this podcast. I really enjoy listening to the podcast and I've learned a lot. So please keep it up.
Thank you so much. I feel the same thing about your Instagram and I'm really excited to read your book.
Okay, well, I'd also like you to submit a drawtonym.
I promise you don't want that. It's not among my skills.
Well, maybe you can submit it anonymously if you want. Or you can even just, maybe you can start practicing now and then next year for next mm-hmm. year's drawtonyms, you can contribute to that contest.
Okay. I'll give it my best, but I'm just warning you. Are there a lot of snake taxonyms? Because I feel like that may be my best shot.
We hardly ever get snakes, so that would be great.
Listen to this, herpetologists. You have an opportunity here. We can be partners in taxonomology. Is that a term? Maybe
it
not.
It is now. It has now been coined.
It's a stretch.
Taxonomology, something along those lines. That's good.
Mike Stiffen's book, Taxonyms, can be purchased wherever books are sold, with 100% of the author proceeds going to the World Wildlife Fund. To learn more about Mike and his work, you can follow him on Instagram at Taxonyms. You can also use the Instagram account to contact him directly with any etymological questions or curiosities.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the New Species Podcast. This podcast was created by Brian Patrick and is edited and produced by Zoe Albion. If you would like to support us, please consider subscribing to our Patreon at patreon.com/newspeciespod. And if you'd like to get in touch with questions or feedback, please email us andnewspeciespodcast@gmail.com.